I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. The jolt that Spirit Airlines caused when it abruptly shut down last weekend felt like a jetliner hitting an air pocket. Tens of thousands of passengers across this hemisphere who had tickets on the popular budget airline were suddenly stranded. A large swath of Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport, Spirit's hub, was now a ghost town. And overnight, more than 10,000 jobs, more than 3,000 of them here in South Florida, were lost. The economic shock to this region is significant. So is the fact that regular Joe travelers have lost another affordable airline. But who's to blame for the sinkhole that ate Spirit? There were external factors like fuel cost spikes due to the Iran war. There were also internal rot, like heavy borrowing. Spirit's low-fare business model could also feel sleight of hand. A trip on the airline included more additional fees than a hospital stay. In the end, amid the bankruptcies and other dramas, did Spirit simply lose much of the cost-conscious flying public it championed? Either way, how have you been affected by Spirit's implosion? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is one of those affected employees, a Spirit flight attendant from Fort Lauderdale named Craig, whose last name we're not using to protect his identity. Craig, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Craig, first of all, we're, of course, very sorry about what's happened to you and the thousands of other Spirit employees this week. Can you describe how you personally experienced Spirit's shutdown last weekend and how you saw the whole tragedy hit your colleagues, passengers, the community, especially yours, Fort Lauderdale?
Well, I was on call when it started. My call period started at midnight, and there was already a bunch of rumors at that point internally that employees were hearing from people who worked in corporate that the end was near. And then shortly after, the media started picking up on it and saying 3 a.m., that was it. And we did not hear anything for probably the last week or so of Spirit.
At what moment did you personally say to yourself, this is it?
I think I told my boyfriend at probably about 11:50. I was like, I'm starting this call period, but I don't think I'm going to be employed by the time it's over.
Yeah, okay. So as that unfolded then, what was it like?
It didn't feel real. I felt like I was watching TV, but like some dramatic show that is depicting this going down and not actually my life. Mm-hmm. I was there for about 8.5 years, mm-hmm. and it still even hasn't sank in all the way yet, I don't think, but it comes in waves. Mm-hmm. Some are better than others. Today's a good day. It's kind of overwhelming, everything that you have to do mm-hmm. afterwards if something like this happens, and it wasn't even our fault. Like doing unemployment, looking for work. Our last most of Spirit is owed 2 paychecks.
Yeah.
Still, because we get paid a month later, so all the money they owe us is for April that we worked.
What were you hearing from your colleagues, from your fellow employees as this was, you know, playing out?
A lot of rumors. Did you hear this? Did you hear that? And speculation, guys. It's been, Spirit was wild with speculation over the past couple of years bankruptcies and mergers. And it's been a lot over the past few years of being in a semi-limbo.
Mm-hmm. What's your biggest complaint, though, about how this all unfolded? And what's your and your fellow employees' biggest fear now as you try to move on from this layoff trauma?
The lack of transparency was pretty consistent, which is unfortunate, because especially we didn't find out till like officially 30 minutes, I think, was we got our email before we ceased operations at 3 a.m. Mm-hmm. So we were kind of left in the dark, and they're like, everything's fine, keep showing up.
But you said that you tend to work overnight
flights. I do.
And so you were sort of you sort of waiting to go to work when this all happened.
I was expecting a call, and it never came. But
where were you going to be flying to?
I was just on call. It was if somebody called out, they would have called me to fill in the spot. So it could have been anywhere.
Mm-hmm. But you mentioned that you fly a lot of international routes as
before,
well.
Before they started cutting routes over the past few months, I did a lot of the international routes to like Central America. Mm-hmm. They were more peaceful. I like the nighttime.
And when you say the lack of transparency about what in particular, you know, seemed most onerous to you?
Our security, because we were seeing these things in the media that all pretty much always ended up being true.
mm-hmm.
at the end of the day. And they're like, no, it's fine. They said this before.
Yeah. Now, you had been a Spirit flight attendant, as you mentioned, for 8 years. You're also a union member.
Yes.
During that time, those 8 years, did episodes like the two bankruptcies the airline went through that you just mentioned earlier, as well as the ultimately frustrated acquisition of Spirit by JetBlue, did all that indicate to you that something was inherently amiss at Spirit, or did you, and especially your union, believe that the airline was going to weather all this and fly on for the long haul?
Part of me did think it was going to weather that. I don't know if it was just me being hopeful, but ever since COVID, it felt like it was a slow decline where people wanted a more premium airline product and to have stuff included and not be having to pay for your water or pay for your stuff, anything, bags or what have you on a budget carrier.
Yeah, I mentioned in my intro those additional fees.
Yeah, and since COVID, before COVID, it was, I considered it like the golden age of flying. But after that, it's something changed. People don't want to sit in a cramped little seat anymore. They want...
That's interesting. Yeah.
So something changed in the traveling public that I think most budget carriers are seeing a struggle, because I know, I mean, I don't work for Frontier, but I know they're not doing particularly great as well as JetBlue.
Did you hear feedback from flyers, from customers and passengers on things like that, you know, laundry list of additional fees that your typical Spirit flyer would have to confront? You know, everything from, you know, having to pay to get your ticket printed out, that sort of thing.
Yes,
is legendary.
Sometimes. Mm-hmm. Most of the time when we, by the time it got to us on the plane, it was usually somebody who hadn't read the baggage thing and had to pay whatever I think it was $90 or $100 at the gate at boarding. Which definitely frustrated a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know bigger carriers have those basic fares, which essentially are the same thing. But I think now that Spirit's gone, that's definitely going to be a problem, because I've already seen, just from looking, there are certain routes. I saw one route from San Francisco to, I think it was Newark or LaGuardia. Mm-hmm. It went from $299 to almost $1,200 within a few days. So it's the fare jumps that they said was going to happen have already started.
But you mentioned that testiness, the chagrin on the part of passengers was much more noticeable after COVID than before.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's just
the
makes
whole
sense, because that's when we started seeing all of the videos of that went viral of passengers fighting with flight attendants.
Yeah.
I mean, that's your profession has been under a lot of stress.
Yeah. Some people jokingly call us the Waffle House of the sky, because we have to deal with that scrappiness that you sometimes see in those Waffle House videos too. Thankfully, I didn't have to deal with that too much, but
right. Well, I want to bring into the conversation here WLRN's senior economics editor, Tom Hudson, who's been following the Spirit story closely for us. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Mm-hmm. Sure thing.
Taking off from what we just heard from Craig about whether or not Spirit's demise was a foregone conclusion, you've noted that just weeks ago, Spirit had issued a plan for emergence from bankruptcy, a company restructuring of sorts, right?
Yeah, Project SOAR was the name of its most recent plan to remake itself and to continue to remake itself in a shrinking airline model, to answer just some of the things that Craig has identified. Yeah. It was just going to be a smaller airline. It was going to fly a lot fewer planes in the air and fewer routes as it tried to shrink its expensive statements in order to be able to pay back its debt that it took on during the pandemic and yet still provide the kind of price competition for flyers. At the same time,
let me just add real quickly. Craig, did you ever hear complaints from employees that the airline perhaps had overextended itself on things like, you know, like flying to Central America and South America, et cetera? What did they feel like that their eyes were bigger than their stomachs?
Probably. I mean, a lot of that expansion that we did was, I think, started in about 2018 or 2019 when I came on board, and we started aggressively route expanding, and then COVID happened, so we had all of this extra stuff out there. We got planes, and then it's like, oh, now we got to pay for all this, and nobody's flying.
Right, the reality.
And then they built that Dania Beach headquarters, and
I want to get to that in a bit. But I'm sorry, Tom. Finish that thought about reducing. Yeah,
I mean, Craig's right. Exactly right. It overexpanded, ran straight into the pandemic, as did the entire industry. Of course, the entire hospitality industry, tourism industry. But Spirit had invested heavily in these new routes, particularly in the Caribbean and in Latin America, Central America, into these regional hubs. Brand new planes, right? It wanted to kind of upscale, begin to upscale the value, the budget conscious flyer that it has been had gotten Spirit to where it was. It began to think about a business class in Spirit, right? Not just going after the tourist market, but really trying to go after a corporate type of market that was more value
conscious. How hard would that have been when, as Craig mentioned, it had this reputation as, you know, the
very
Waffle
difficult
House of the
as
sky.
It turns out, right? Yeah. Untested because it just didn't have enough runway, pun intended, to get there because of the financing and all the borrowing that it took on during the pandemic.
Anything else about the restructuring that stuck out for you?
Well,
the potential restructuring.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is it did not forecast jet fuel prices doubling in the course of a month because of the war in Iran. And that's really what it ran into as much as everything else with its failed merger from JetBlue and whatnot.
We're going to get into that. Yep. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Spirit Airlines flight attendant Craig, whose last name we are not using, who was one of the thousands of employees who lost their jobs when Spirit shut down last weekend, and with WLRN's Tom Hudson. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Tom Hudson, I just want to pivot from that airline restructuring plan that Spirit hoped would mean survival to the reality that came crashing down last weekend. What in the end, from the Iran war energy crisis that you just mentioned to its own flawed business model, caused the Spirit shutdowns? What lessons need to be taken from it? And is the cost-conscious flying public going to miss this airline, especially as we head into a summer of rising fares?
I think we will. I'm one of those flyers that have used Spirit, being cost-conscious as I am. And I think
you're from Iowa.
I am from Iowa. Yeah. I'm frugal, right? Yeah, exactly, as I like to tell my wife. Not cheap, but frugal.
Exactly.
Yes, because, I mean, as Craig mentioned, right, you just look at that route from San Francisco and the price increases. I mean, there's been research, there's been academic research that has shown when Spirit entered a market, when Spirit entered a route, the effect, the downward pressure a Spirit route would have on other routes from that same airport. That was the case because of Spirit's unbundling, right? It really invented and then reinvented flying for the budget-conscious consumer over the course of the early 2000s, the 2010s, before it overexpanded and then, of course, ran into the pandemic. So working backwards, right? Mm-hmm. High jet fuel prices that it did not anticipate and did not model in its bankruptcy emergence plan. Yeah. And then you, of course, have the more competition from the budget-conscious flyer, more cost-conscious, and the heavy borrowing during the pandemic.
And just real quick, you summarized it for me earlier this week in a way that I'd love you to repeat to our listeners.
Ultimately, Spirit was eaten by its own business model, eaten by its own success because of what it invented, and other airlines, legacy airlines included, have, you know, went to unbundling their fares as well.
Craig, I want to pose the same questions to you, but obviously from a labor perspective, as a Spirit employee on the daily front lines, what did you feel might have been flawed about the airline's business model and strategy, but also what did you feel was right about the business that the public is going to find it's a shame to lose?
Well, towards the end, especially on the latter part of that question, Spirit was making steps at the end to improve the cabins. We already had two rows of first class type seats. They didn't recline.
The big seats.
Yes, we had the big seats in the front, and then towards the end, we ended up doing it towards like an actual like first class kind of product where all the drinks and snacks and alcohol were included in that. And we did take out one row in the main cabin so that we could have a part of the cabin that had a lot more leg room in there.
Okay. Yeah.
And could you, what was the first part?
Well, what did you feel maybe was flawed as an employee about the business model you were working in on the front lines every day?
There was a lot of change. First, it was like blocking the seats, and then there would be, oh no, we're taking the row out, and then certain passengers would get discounts or snacks included, and it just kept flip-flopping, and a lot of passengers got irritated with that because they'd be like, this is what I booked.
Okay. So an inconsistency there.
And towards the end, they'd be like, oh, do this. Oh, let's try this. And it felt like they were just like grabbing out of the hats.
But what about the Spirit model do you think passengers, as I was asking Tom, are going to miss? What is the flying public going to miss that you thought maybe was, you know, was good about the business you were working for?
The affordability of travel, definitely. Because it's, like I mentioned earlier, it's already going up. And as a granted, probably after this month, more so after the airlines that have pledged the cheaper fares to get people back are probably winding up soonish now.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see a big jump.
Tom, whatever the cause of Spirit's collapse, the bottom line now is that thousands of laid-off employees need help, like Craig. A major South Florida airport has about a third of its gates empty now. Yep. And the local economy that Spirit helped buttress, especially, you know, up there in Broward County, is feeling the jolt. I know you've been looking at ways Spirit says it can aid its employees and how JetBlue can perhaps help Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport. What are you seeing?
Yeah, JetBlue has announced some new routes out of FLL and did so relatively fast. You know, the irony, of course, is that part of Spirit's downfall was its inability to merge with JetBlue, and the Justice Department, a federal judge rather, stepped in front of that merger saying it was anti-competitive, and here we are now left without Spirit. And JetBlue has stepped in. I think Frontier and some of those other ultra-low-cost providers will be looking at routes in and out of South Florida, particularly those that it feels are going to be able to fly with full planes and with planes coming into Florida. Mm-hmm. Now, they've got some runway here, again, pun intended, because, you know, that summer inbound traffic is not necessarily as large as what it could be in December, January,
February. How do you see Spirit stepping up to help people like Craig?
Well, we'll have to see here, right? I mean, Craig obviously has a collective bargaining agreement. We'll see where the union sits in line with the creditors, mentioning, you know, the missing paychecks, Craig. I hope that you're able and your colleagues are able to be filled up with what is at least owed to you.
And a lot of us did have unused vacation time and sick time, too.
Right.
So we're sitting there, like, I think, including all the benefits that are owed to me that were when operations ceased, it's almost about 2 months of pay.
Craig, I know you've mentioned you love being a flight attendant and you want to continue in that profession. I saw yesterday that Miami International Airport, for example, was hosting a job fair for Spirit employees. Are you confident that Spirit, or not confident, that your union and the industry and the airline will be offering enough assistance to you, to people like you, to get you back on your feet?
As far as the industry, yes. Spirit, I'm not holding my breath.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, given the week before the bankruptcy started, the first one, they C-suite gave themselves very large bonuses and retention bonuses. And at this point, I believe that they are trying to do it again and try to sidestep whatever the courts are wanting them to do. Mm-hmm. And so that they can get their last retention bonus. And I know it's in the millions, but there's 17,000 of us that...
But you feel there's a future for you in the industry?
Oh, yes,
still
absolutely.
As a flight attendant.
Several of the airlines, Southwest, Frontier, United, American, are all making special sites for Spirit employees to have a direct. It's not going to give you preferential treatment in hiring, but it will get you to the front of the line to get that interview. I know next week Allegiant is doing a job fair in Fort Lauderdale for Spirit employees at a hotel. I know that they said there's more details to come, but the airlines are stepping up.
I hope that leads you on a path down to rebound then, Craig.
Thank you.
Craig, we're not using his last name, is now a former Spirit Airlines flight attendant. Tom Hudson is WLRN Senior Economics Editor. Thank you to you both.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, Palm Beach International Airport gets named for President Trump after a Trump deal, of course. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. President Trump's name is ubiquitous. It's on high-rises, casinos, golf courses. There's even a Trump-endorsed Bible. But Trump has never had his moniker on an airport, until now. This week, the Palm Beach County Commission approved a deal that would rename Palm Beach International Airport to President Donald J. Trump International Airport. Usually, presidents don't get airports named for them until they're out of office or dead. But hey, this is, after all, the airport next door to Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate. No, the really unusual thing about naming Palm Beach International for President Trump is the Trump deal-making that had to be hammered out before it could happen. Turns out, in order for Palm Beach County to do the president the honor of putting his brand on its airport, it first had to strike a deal with that brand, an agreement protecting his trademark, as it were. What's more, in fact, Trump's business and family could benefit financially from the arrangement, according to people who have seen the contract. One of those people joins me now. She's Claire Heddles, senior political correspondent for the Miami Herald, who's been doing great reporting on this story. And we would, of course, like to know our listeners' thoughts on this Trump airport renaming deal. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Claire, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Let's just start by reminding folks how this all came about. Whose idea was it to name the Palm Beach International after President Trump, especially while he's still in office and still, well, alive? I mean, Reagan International in Washington, D.C., named for Ronald Reagan a decade after he left the White House. JFK in New York, named for John F. Kennedy a month after his death. Why is an airport being named now for Donald J. Trump?
Right. So this is a, you know, proposal that was pushed by Republican state lawmakers in the legislature this year. And Palm Beach County officials really had no say in it until, or very little say, until their vote on this contract this week. And, you know, the Republican lawmakers that pushed it, you're absolutely right. It is unprecedented to have an airport named after a sitting president, you know, rare for it to be a living president, but much less a sitting president. Meg Weinberger, who's the Palm Beach County state rep who sponsored the bill, you know, she told me, why do you have to wait for people to die to honor them?
But oh, sure, I think there's also no rule, yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, people know that Trump likes to be celebrated. He likes to be praised. He makes no secret about that. And I think he often rewards people who do so. And, you know, Meg Weinberger, who sponsored this bill this week right after the contract passed, he then, you know, endorsed her in her center, in her state house race on Truth Social. So, you know, they said they wanted to honor him for what he's done and his legacy. But it is unusual to have a sitting president be honored. And some of the Democrats in the House that opposed it said, you know, they were concerned that after his presidency and as his legacy gets cemented in the years to come, is the state or the county going to be on the line to change the name again at some point? And doing it while he's still president sort of puts them at that risk.
Right. They felt. Well, for the current moment, then, will the airport's code now be changed from PBI to DJT, or does the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, have the final say on that?
Right. So the state bill to rename the airport has two provisions or two hurdles that had to be cleared. Basically, the FAA agreeing to it and, yes, changing the code from PBI to DJT. And Trump's companies have trademarked the name DJT, which they, you know, will give the airport the authority to use. And the Department of Transportation has signaled they are planning to, you know, fast track that approval. So that should happen soon. And then the second hurdle was this trademark contract that the county negotiated.
Right. Let's get to that. Let's get right to the deal that Palm Beach County and President Trump had to hammer out before this renaming could happen. Claire, what was the central issue, especially in terms of the president, his family, and his businesses needing to retain control over his Trump brand, trademark, whatever you want to call it? What all went into this deal or had to go into this deal?
So, I mean, the deal itself is unusual. The other airports that are named after presidents, the public agency that runs the airport owns the trademark to the name. The Trump Organization has said that this trademark, you know, was necessary because, quote, Trump's name is the most infringed upon name in the world is what, you know, is what they said. And the county also had asked the state legislators to put this provision in to ensure that they had some say at the state, at the table, to try to sort of protect them legally if they use the name. I think the county felt that having the trademark issue cleared up would be the easiest way for them to ensure that they weren't going to get sued over using Trump's name in the future if Trump had an issue with with the way the airport was ran.
But just to put, I want to make sure that, you know, that our listeners have this in context. You know, for example, back in 1998 when Washington, D.C. International Airport there was renamed for Ronald Reagan, there was no issue with the Reagan family or any other entity associated with the Reagan family about, you know, how, you know, his name could be used. You know, that airport, known by its code DCA, is still DCA, and there was no issue about, you know, any conflict with, you know, the Reagan family and its entities and, you know, the public government there that runs the airport, right?
Right. Yes. And in this situation, you know, it's not, it is a new trademark that a Trump affiliated company filed in February. It is not an existing trademark they already had. They, you know, filed for the trademark for Donald J. Trump International Airport so that they own it rather than, you know, having the county file it and own that trademark.
I would imagine. Well, I want to get to that, but yeah, that would seem to maybe raise a few red flags for, you know, your typical government watchdog. No.
Definitely. And when this happened in February, we covered it then too, that, you know, it raised these flags about why is this a privately held trademark for a public taxpayer funded building? You know, that's when the Trump Organization told us, well, no, this is, you know, this is just to protect him. And the county told us that they felt like it was the best legal option was for Trump's company to hold the trademark. But then this week when we saw the contract deal came out, it did seem to be there are some oddities in it that trademark attorneys told me are not typical in trademark agreements that suggest there are ways in which Trump's companies could profit.
Yeah. And I want to get to that. But I just want to reiterate to people, though, that, again, as you mentioned, the Palm Beach officials, as you mentioned in your report this week, they feel, you know, aside from all these other issues, it was just necessary for Palm Beach County to do this to protect it, to insulate it, the county, from any future, you know, legal conflicts because it is using the Trump name, right?
Yes, that is my understanding from what they've said. I mean, in December, when the state legislature was first considering this, they started talking to Palm Beach County administrators. The county commission never voted on it, but the administrators did talk to the legislators. And the county raised a whole slew of concerns, kind of legal concerns that they could be sued, concerns that they would have to rename the airport if, you know, their political tides change and pay for dollars again.
Yeah.
You know, safety concerns of having to reroute funds to renaming from other projects at the airport, security concerns. I mean, all kinds of things that they were worried about. And the sort of agreement that they came to with the legislators that was that negotiating a deal with Trump's company regarding a trademark is the best way to give the county some power over this when they really had very little say otherwise.
Now, the red flag that the contract raises, however, is, as you mentioned, that President Trump, his family, and his businesses do stand to benefit financially from this deal precisely because his name is a trademark brand. You report, Claire, that he and his businesses can't profit from the sale of Trump-branded merchandise at the airport itself, but they can sell Trump airport-branded swag off-site. How does that all work, and is it kosher since Palm Beach International is, as you and I just mentioned, a public taxpayer-funded airport?
In theory, yes. The part of the agreement was that the county can distribute promotional items without having to purchase them from Trump-approved retailers. But there were, you know, two things that were related to the sale of items that were a little bit odd. One was the fact that this agreement is a non-exclusive agreement, which, you know, lets Trump companies use the Donald J. Trump International Airport name and logo. They can sell it elsewhere as long as they don't make money from the purchase or sale of items on site at the airport. And then the second sort of oddity that an outside trademark attorney pointed out to me was that it requires all the stores within the airport to buy their merchandise from a retailer that Trump's company chooses.
Right. And you name that company in your report. Can you remind me of the name of that company?
So the trademark company that owns the trademark is called DTTM Operations.
Right. Okay.
They have not yet chosen who the merchandiser will be. And they committed not to make money off of the, you know, purchasing of this item, but it does give them power to choose who the merchandiser is, which, you know, those kind of business relationships are beneficial, even if you're not directly profiting.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with the Miami Herald's Claire Heddles about the unusual deal that was struck to rename the Palm Beach International Airport for President Trump. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Claire, we were just discussing the potential and admittedly controversial ways in which President Trump and his business interests could potentially profit from the renaming of Palm Beach International Airport to President Donald J. Trump International Airport. Did those concerns weigh on the Palm Beach County Commission's vote this week to approve the renaming? And I ask that because I saw the vote was 4-3, not exactly unanimous.
Exactly. And the commission is actually a Democratic favoring commission. There's four Democrats and three Republicans. All three Republicans, backed this contract deal, and one Democrat also backed the contract deal. And then the other three Democrats opposed it. They said, one of their biggest concerns was that they didn't see the contract until Monday, and then they were taking a vote on Tuesday. So they said they had very little time, to review this document and to determine whether it really was in the county's best interest. And they felt like they were just having to, go on faith. The other, I think, concern that those who voted against it had was that there's no way for them to end it or revise the contract. It is non-terminable. So they were worried that it was locking the county into very specific language that they had had, very little time to review and would have no options to alter in the future.
So in the future, as you were talking about before, as you know, if a political climate changes in this country 10 or 20 years from now and they want to name it after somebody else, they're hemmed in to keeping it named Donald J. Trump International?
Yes, unless the state passes a law changing the name, they are hemmed in. And even I don't know, I'm not sure about this, but it's possible that there are other ramifications of being tied into this contract.
We have Sean on the line. Sean, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What's your perspective on this?
Hey, good afternoon, sir. Just don't think it's that unusual. They can do it, posthumously or, before, but I just don't think it's a big deal. I think he's very patriotic. I think it would be good for PBI. He's done a lot for the community, he's done a lot for the city. He's a big face, he's a big name in that community, so I don't see an issue with it. I think people are making a big deal out of it like they usually do, and that's it. I'll take the rest off the air.
Sean, are you calling from Palm Beach County?
No, Dade County.
All right. Just wanted to check. Well, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. Claire, another provision of the deal that seems to stand out is that President Trump gets control over any biographical information about him and his presidency that might be presented at the airport that's now named after him. Is that unusual as well? I mean, again, did Ronald Reagan and his family get that kind of say over what's at the DC airport in that vein, for example?
Yeah, that is the kind of third thing, in addition to the non-exclusive agreement and the airport sales being tied to Trump-approved companies. The third thing that the trademark attorney that, looked at it with me pointed out as being unusual compared to other commercial trademark agreements was this veto power over how his name, image, and biographical information is used. So any sort of promotional materials about the airport that describe Donald Trump, his company gets 30 days to approve or deny those. Then the county has to, change it to his wishes. And then they get 10 more days to again approve or deny and sort of have executive veto power. So if they want to include a Trump biography somewhere in the airport, it would have to be written in such a way that Trump's company is, and Trump himself feel is the way that he wants it to be written, which I think some of the commissioners raised concerns about this week as well.
Now, Claire, I just want to end here by reminding people about a bit of an irony here is that once President Trump used to file lawsuits against the Palm Beach International Airport because he said the noise disturbed his nearby Mar-a-Lago estate residence and its golf course. I take it his feeling about the airport has changed now?
I think so. I think his feelings have changed. Though I do think the fact that he has sued the airport in the past might have been part of what made, the county want to ensure that they had a deal in writing.
Very good point.
He's not going to sue them again.
Claire Heddles is the Miami Herald senior political correspondent. Claire, many thanks.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, Cubans feel like unusual targets in the immigration crackdown. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Paget. Historically, Cubans have had an easier immigration path into the U.S. than most national groups, largely because they're considered escapees from their island's repressive communist dictatorship. Under the 1966 Cuban Adjustment Act, Cubans had enjoyed a relatively fast track to a green card or legal U.S. residency. But under President Trump's second administration, that has changed dramatically. Just how dramatically was laid out recently. in a report by the Libertarian Cato Institute think tank in Washington, D.C. It documents soaring immigration arrests and plummeting green card approvals for all migrants, but especially Cubans. Since last year, the detentions of Cubans have shot up 463%, and their approval for legal residency has plunged almost 100%. Meanwhile, many now face deportation back to an economic catastrophe made worse by Trump's blockade of oil to Cuba. Have you been affected by the unprecedented immigration crackdown on Cuban migrants? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Alina Santana. She is a Cuban-American immigration attorney who heads the Santana Residency Law firm in Miami and who is on the front lines of this situation, which, of course, inordinately impacts Miami-Dade County, where more than a third of the population is Cuban. Alina, always good to have you on the program.
Same, Tim. Thank you so much for having me back on.
I want to go straight to the Cato study's most notable assertion. I mean, the author, David Beer, is a well-regarded immigration policy analyst. We've interviewed him several times here at WLRN. But I'm curious to know your response to his claim that, quote, Cuban immigrants have faced an even more concerted targeting by immigration enforcement since last year, especially by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Does he make a valid point?
You know, I think he does. While the Cuban Adjustment Act still exists on paper, as you mentioned, and it is, you know, passed by the legislature, so it can't be terminated that easily. But the infrastructure that has allowed Cubans to use the act really has been systematically dismantled by the Trump administration. And it's really leaving the door open for removing a lot of Cubans and not letting them qualify. So I completely do agree with the assertion.
Okay. And we should point out the Cato study looks at all migrant groups in the U.S., not just Cubans. But as we just mentioned, it does focus a lot on the heavier immigration enforcement burden that the Cuban community seems to be experiencing under the second Trump administration. Did the data that Beer presented, Alina, the 463% leap in detention of Cuban migrants, for example, did that surprise you or did you see that coming?
You know, I think the number is quite stark. I was surprised to see it. We've absolutely seen more detentions here locally in South Florida. I believe I just looked it up recently, and the Miami field office specifically has made 41,310 arrests since January of 2025. That's an unprecedented number, and it is the most of any other office, according to a recent New York Times article that came out. Mm-hmm. And we have been seeing that locally. We've been seeing more detention. I don't think I realized just how high the number was.
That surprises me as well.
It's absolutely nuts. And you know, specifically also with removals, Tim, you and I were talking before I got on about we're looking at 2 to 3 flights a week that Cubans are being deported to Mexico, interestingly.
Yeah. And the other thing that he points out is the 100% decline in approvals of green cards or legal residency for Cubans. Let's look at what the Cato study calls the main culprit of all that, then, the freezing of green card or legal residency processing or adjudication by USCIS, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which puts migrants in a limbo that makes them vulnerable to detention and deportation. That would seem to be a pipeline where there are more Cuban migrants than other groups because of the fact that the Cuban Adjustment Act we mentioned before gets them into that pipeline faster. Is that an accurate way of looking at it?
Yes, if they qualify, they are filing. But because all of these applications are just being held in abeyance and in limbo, we are seeing more and more of them clogging the pipes, for lack of a better word. And the statistics show that there have only been about 15 green cards approved this year out of about 7,000 pending.
Right. That you mentioned that to me this morning, and that I was struck by that as well. So USCIS, though, claims that this is due to the Trump administration's designation of Cuba and other countries such as Venezuela as, quote, high risk in terms of, you know, accepting immigrants from those countries. But you pointed out to me earlier that one of the things that also stands out is that the phenomenon the Cato report points to involves documented as well as undocumented migrants, right?
Yeah, that's correct. It's documented and undocumented people.
Right. Why is that so important, though?
A little bit outside of our current conversation, but there's a huge economic impact to us not giving people status in the US. There's some real fiscal arguments for why immigration is important to the US. Immigrants, both documented and undocumented, really give back in taxes more than they ever take from our system. So it does impact our economy.
No, I know that's something David Beer at the Cato Institute often points out is that, you know, the immigrants, whether they're documented or undocumented, pay more into the system in this country than they receive back in benefits, correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Coral Gables immigration attorney Elena Santana about Cubans feeling the unusual brunt of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Elena, let's back up a little and remind people why these new immigration hardships Cubans are facing are so unusual and unprecedented for this community.
Yeah, so there's always been favorable policies in place for Cubans. And I say always, maybe not always, but usually, right? We see Cubans being paroled in at a higher rate than other groups. We have things like the reunification program, the Cuban Family Reunification Parole Program that was special for them. We've had other parole programs through CBP-1 and such. And essentially, the administration has terminated most ways that Cubans can go about getting parole. That combined with the stopping of the processing really has affected Cuban immigrants specifically way more, I think, than many other groups.
Yeah, now, but we should point out it's not as if this reversal of immigration privilege, if we can call it that, just happened, you know, overnight when, you know, when President Trump took office again last year. I mean, I remember you and me first talking about this growing anxiety for Cubans, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, back in the Biden administration, especially when it came to something that I know weighs heavily on the Cuban migrant community's mind these days, that the notorious I-220A form, right? So should the community be surprised? You know, walk us through how this process really, as I said, just isn't an overnight phenomenon.
No, it's not. And you know, we can go even further back and talk about some of the last things that Obama did in his administration was end the wet foot, dry foot policy. To me, that was the beginning of the shifting tide,
Yeah, and
actually.
Alina, I think you need to, you know, it's been so long. Precisely, you need to go back and explain to people what wet foot, dry foot was.
Yeah, so the wet foot, dry foot policy was about whether someone was allowed into the US and someone specifically a Cuban. And the idea was the wet foot was they were caught in the ocean, the dry foot was they actually stepped on land. And the policy back then was if they made it to land, and we're talking mostly about people coming in through boats and rafts, they were granted a parole. And this parole is that lawful entry into the US. So Obama, one of his very last acts in office was actually to suspend that program. From there, it got carried over in the administrations. We went into Trump and then later Biden. So I do think the tide has been coming.
Yeah.
And I just think this last bit with the parole programs disappearing has made it
And
worse.
Alina, let's go back. And I mean, I remember when wet foot, dry foot was eliminated by the Obama administration, though, ironically, it had the approval of, you know, very hardline Cuban exile politicians here like Ileana Ross Leighton, Marco Rubio. I mean, explain to people the rationale that behind eliminating wet foot, dry foot back then.
You know, it's interesting because this issue specifically, I think, has crossed the aisle a little bit. The idea was that there was a privilege being granted to Cubans, right? And the more liberal democratic side of this argument has always been that the Cubans shouldn't have this special preference that exists. And then the more conservative and Republican argument has generally been that they are special because of the policies happening in Cuba and because of our fight against the regime.
Right.
It's
But
interesting to
no,
see
I'm
it.
sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, to me, it's been very interesting to see the shift cross the aisle,
Right.
is all.
But I was going to interject with it, but there was also some abuse of wet foot, dry foot going on that helped lead to that bipartisan push to eliminate wet foot, dry foot. In particular, a lot of Medicare fraud, Medicaid fraud that was going on amongst Cuban migrants at that time, right?
Yeah, not just Medicare fraud, but just benefits fraud in general, I'd say. As a result of claiming that you are a refugee, you are entitled to more benefits than a typical immigrant would. So there was some abuse, I have to admit, and I think the statistics do show
Yeah.
that did not help the case.
And again, going back to, how this reversal started, explain to people why this notorious I-220A form became such an integral part of what's happening to Cuban migrants now.
Yeah, what's essentially happening, this I-220 form is really a question of is it a parole or is it not? And this was a document being issued upon entry as an alternative to the original way parole happened, which was a nice stamp that you got in your passport.
Yeah.
And because this has become a legal argument between the courts and it's still pending with the Board of Immigration Appeals, we really don't know yet if they have a parole or they don't have a parole. And that is fundamental to applying and adjusting under the Cuban Adjustment Act for a green card.
Yeah, I brought it up because it's just something that Cuban migrants and their families need to be aware of when they come to immigration attorneys like yourself. But immigration attorneys like yourself, Elena, how are you seeing this play out, particularly for Cuban families and detentions, deportations? How do you see this, affecting the community, from where you sit?
Unfortunately, we're seeing a lot, everybody's in limbo waiting for these rulings. There's constant movement back and forth from our appellate courts and such. So, a lot of people in limbo, a lot of people uncertain, definitely affecting everyone as far as work permits and ability to make permanent plans. And then, add to that on the detention side, we are seeing more and more Cubans detained at ICE appointments. We're seeing more and more Cubans actually being physically deported to third countries, not just Mexico, some worse ones.
Yeah.
And it's really affecting a huge portion of our population since there are so many Cubans in South Florida.
Yeah, and I think we need to clarify that. What is the situation with Cuba? I think, when we talk about this situation, people envision, Cubans being deported back to Cuba. But you're making the very good reminder that actually, no, they're being, a lot of them sent to third countries like Mexico. What is the situation bilaterally between the U.S. and Cuba in terms of Cuba receiving Cuban deportees?
Yeah, so essentially, Cuba doesn't want to receive the majority of their deportees. So, unless Cuba gives approval to receive them, the US doesn't send them and they won't accept them, which has always been what's happened and why so many Cubans with deportation orders still live here.
Yeah.
However, because of our agreements now with third countries like Mexico, who's agreed to accept them, what we are seeing is Cubans being physically deported as opposed to just having a deportation order on paper. So I've had clients who've been here 40 years and they've never been deported. They've had a deportation order and suddenly they're finding themselves in Mexico because of
Right.
our there.
Now, Lena, just the minute we have left, a couple weeks ago, a federal judge in Maryland ordered USIS to resume processing and adjudicating green cards for legal residency. Does that mean relief is coming for migrants like Cubans now?
I think more interestingly, what's going to happen is we'll have different courts giving different decisions, and it'll just climb up and up the ladder until we have perhaps a Supreme Court decision that actually resolves everything.
Okay. All great points. Elena Santana is an immigration attorney who heads Santana Residency Law in Miami. Elena, many thanks as always. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Tim. Take care.
You too. Finally, on the roundup, let's pivot to another community vital to South Florida. We're in the delightful thick of Haitian Heritage Month. It's celebrated in May because May 18th is Haitian Flag Day, one of the most important dates on the Haitian calendar. It kicked off last weekend, and this weekend offers especially rich fare here in South Florida, including a program this evening called Lahai Pam at the Perez Art Museum, Miami, and a 10K community walk tomorrow in Miami. Next Friday evening, May 15th, offers one of Haitian Heritage Month's top events, the Sounds of Little Haiti at the Little Haiti Cultural Complex. One of the featured performers will be iconic Haitian compa music band Tabu Combo. Haitian Heritage Month also includes compa dance classes at the Little Haiti Cultural Complex. See you there.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Katie and Denise. Denise Royal is the senior producer of content, streaming, and news products. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is WLRN's digital director. Sergio Bustos is our vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.